This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. A recent report from Fidelity Investments says that a couple that is retiring this year can expect to spend $300,000 in healthcare expenses during your retirement. Well, how can one prepare for so much money that you have to spend on healthcare expenses? For that, we turn to Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer, who has some information, some good tips for us. And Greg, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
Well, tell us more about this recent study from Fidelity that talks about so much. And I guess it's a new milestone that has now we see come about and how much it costs for caring for oneself during retirement.
Yeah, you know, there's so much new information in regards around that. I think, you know, a lot of it really has to do with just medicine, really, for the life expectancy to continue to go up with individuals in the area. That increases the length that you're in retirement. So obviously, you know, the exposure or the amount of time that you have to, you know, pay for things around premiums, even dental expenses that typically aren't covered, and more importantly, stuff like your extended care. So they moved that number up considerably in terms of what they estimate the average person will need throughout their retirement.
What tips can you offer in ways to help everybody, for that matter, but in particular, retirees or people who are going to be retiring soon to be able to prepare for the possibility of having these higher health care costs to account for?
Yeah, there's a couple things. I mean, without stating the obvious, so, you know, we all, I think, can do a better job of trying to live a healthier lifestyle, you know, and try to, you know, the best way to prevent, you know, those high medical expenses is to keep yourself in shape and continue to do the regular checkups, catch things early, eat healthy, exercise. All those things decrease stress, decrease the strain on your body, and, you know, help in regards to, you know, the types of care that you might need moving forward. But, you know, once you get beyond the obvious, there's, you know, the biggest thing, that gap that we find a lot is, you know, people need to plan for it. You know, a lot of people go into retirement and they have, you know, their financial nest egg, so to speak, their portfolio. But, you know, having the portfolio, the money you've saved either in a 401k, IRA, brokerage accounts, whatever it might be, you know, portfolio is not a plan. And the plan is what allows you to kind of estimate those expenses. You can add inflationary expenses to the health costs and plan to have that as an expense in your retirement, and it'll give you a clearer picture, a better roadmap of, you know, what your position is and how much you can spend on other things in retirement, and, you know, estimating based on your living expenses, will your portfolio support that? You know, what types of money can I withdraw? What types of risks am I exposed to? And one of those risks that you need to plan for is health insurance.
Mm-hmm. I guess a portfolio is basically just a big pot that you put everything in, and that's what you have to draw from.
Yeah, and, you know, the difference between, you know, just like the wealth management aspect, wealth management obviously is important. You know, you want to make sure that you're diversified properly, that you have your assets matching your risk tolerance. But when you get into planning, it really begins to identify certain things that change as you move into retirement. You know, during your accumulation phase of your life, when you're saving, you're not drawing. So there's not the same types of risks with things like sequence risk. You know, the taxes, the withdrawal, there's not decisions to be made about that. Healthcare is generally covered through your group plan. Inflationary is covered with your wages. So all those additional things that you now have to begin to plan for based on what you save happen as you enter that distribution phase. And that's really where the value is planning, not so much return, because those particular risks could derail your retirement.
I suppose we talk about this on occasion, but it should be brought up again in talking about dealing with health care costs. If you're still working in particular, or certainly, I guess, even if you're working part-time, if you can take advantage of a health savings account, that's probably a good idea if you don't have one.
Oh, absolutely, because these things can, the health savings account can actually carry over into your retirement. Often you have a lot of discretion as to how you want those investments handled inside, or how the money is invested inside, I should say. And so if you can carry over some dollars into this health savings account, it can be used as needed throughout your retirement for things that aren't covered. Particularly, you know, most people don't realize going into retirement that dental is very difficult to get covered when you go to your individual plans, mm-hmm. and it's usually very limited. And as we get older, generally you experience more problems with dental, and that could become a very substantial cost and expense. It's not unheard of to have a $8,000, $10,000, $12,000, $20,000 procedure that needs to be done if there's major work that is involved with whatever issues you have going on.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about dealing with health care costs upon retirement, or for preparing to retire for that matter. Social Security, we've talked about that in general terms before, but that's obviously very important to bring up at this point.
Yeah, I mean, Social Security is one of those things you got to understand, and this is where the planning aspect, in my opinion, becomes very critical, because one of the risks that we all have is longevity. You know, the longer we live, the more likely we're going to experience market volatility, inflation, tax law changes, all the things that could, you know, derail the retirement. So understanding, you know, how Social Security can benefit, when and how to collect it, can make a substantial difference in the predictability, as we call it, of the outcome of your retirement plan, and can result in pretty substantial dollars over your lifetime that you would benefit based on the timing of when you started.
And besides Social Security, one should know as much as you can about Medicare. And I know that there are things that you, I guess you could start from, is knowing what the difference is between what is called a Medicare supplement and a Medicare Advantage plan. Will you bring us up to date on that?
Yeah, there's a lot of the thing about Medicare is it can be overwhelming, because it's new. It's a decision we have to make unlike any in our lifetime before. And as you enter that, based on the direction that you choose, may eliminate options that you would have in the future to go back to. For example, if you decide to start on the Medicare Advantage side of it, you know, then you have health questions to be able to get back on the traditional Medigap policies. So really getting a core understanding of the differences between the typical Medicare supplement and Advantage plan, understanding all your options and your exposure, understanding that, you know, moving forward, you know, do we want a controlled expense, meaning higher premium, or are we willing to take the risk-reward of lower premiums with potentially higher expenses? And it's just a matter of, you know, understanding where those gaps would be in those policies, particularly in the prescriptions. You know, that's another medical expense we didn't even talk about in the beginning.
Yeah.
And most people are familiar with that donut hole terminology, but what does it mean and what is my exposure? And that could be substantial dollars for an individual or couple over their retirement.
And finally, long-term care. We've talked about some of these other Advantage things that you need to know about. And if you don't know already, you need to look ahead and what you have to plan for as far as expenses are concerned for long-term care, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, a lot of people say, well, I'm not going to go there. I'm just going to stay at home. And, you know, and while everybody, I believe, would rather do that, the unfortunate reality of it is, as we continue to extend lifestyle with medicine and medical procedures, as our body begins to age, it's just a high likelihood that we're going to have some type of extended time, either in an in-home care situation or a care facility, and that could become substantially expensive. And if there's a surviving spouse involved, particularly, you know, that again is something when we go back to the plan. How would my portfolio hold up against, you know, an additional expense or substantial expense of, say, $100,000 in a year, and how would that leave the surviving spouse, and what's the best way to mitigate that risk and protect against it? And there's a lot of things that you can do, but understand that it's expensive. I mean, you're probably looking anywhere from $7,000 to $12,000 per month if you end up in, you know, some type of extended care facility.
Well, it's something more to look at. Talk about the expenses that you have as you retire, and if you don't account for health care, then you're going to find it's going to be even more expensive to retire, to be sure. And we talk about the being able, if it's possible, physically as well as financially, to be able to delay retirement. And another reason, I guess, we need to look at that option too, don't we?
Absolutely.
Greg Hammer's a Northwest Indiana financial advisor. We turn to him for topics of interest in finances and retirement. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. After slavery was abolished and African Americans began to move from the places they'd been forced to live in, white communities began to revolt. They ran black people out of their cities or counties under threat of violence or death and enacted laws to keep them out. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Ella Abbott looked into this history of towns with signs warning black Americans to stay out after sundown. They were called sundown towns, and they arose in the early to mid-1900s, and their effects continue in many towns today.
Sundown towns are towns that were, for decades, all white on purpose, and some of them still are. It turns out that they're all across the Midwest.
That's James Lowen, the author of Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. Lowen has spent years researching and trying to catalog towns that historically kept black people out of them by whatever means necessary. Some towns had signs that made their intentions clear. One that says whites only within city limits after dark covers the front of Lowen's book. Others used more crass language, racial slurs, or threats of violence to get their point across.
They're in Oregon, they're in California, they're in the far west, Pennsylvania. They're almost everywhere except the traditional South.
Sundown towns weren't typically a Southern thing, Lowen says, because in the South, white people wanted black people in their towns to do the jobs they didn't want to do. Janitors, maids, cotton pickers.
But across the Midwest, all kinds of towns, hundreds of them in Indiana.
Between the 1890s and the 1940s, sundown towns became a popular trend in northern states. In his book, Lowen profiles three Indiana towns, Elwood, Huntington, and Martinsville. John Aiden is the executive director of the African American Historical Society Museum in Fort Wayne. He remembers Martinsville, Indiana, as an unfriendly place.
You could not be caught in that county or anywhere near that town, even during the day, let alone at night.
Aiden says the beginning of sundown towns have ties to past laws from the antebellum period before the Civil War. Past laws allowed enslaved African Americans to conduct business for their owners, which sometimes meant they were also allowed to travel after dark. In the North, Southern slave owners would travel with their enslaved people. Aiden says many scholars believe sundown towns arose after the Civil War as a means of keeping black labor in the counties where they lived, rather than allowing them the safety to move to new counties.
After the Civil War, many white Americans who had relied on enslaved African American labor were not intending to farm their own land or, you know, perform the activities that they felt were beneath their station in life. And so that meant retaining black labor.
Some sundown towns had official legislation on their books to keep black people out of their cities. But most, Aiden says, were extrajudicial.
A lot of African Americans would just know which towns were sundown towns or cities and which ones to avoid by nightfall.
Today, some towns have officially removed sundown legislation from their books, but many towns have swept the past under the rug. In his book, Lowen tells of asking local librarians if they saved the threatening signs or photos of them, and recalls them often laughing at the question, asking, "Why would we do that?" In northeast Indiana, the city of Huntington has been documented as a confirmed sundown town on Lowen's website. Huntington Mayor Richard Strick says that while the city has come a long way, a lack of documentation can make having conversations about that time difficult and hard to relate the current environment to the city's past.
Even before you get into people feeling like they're not responsible for what happened here historically and the various tensions that we're all living through in our nation right now and trying to have these conversations.
In 2009, Huntington unveiled a new mission statement which mentions its citizens, quote, "ethnic, economic, and religious diversity provides the strength that holds our community together," and says it's a, quote, "community of civility and inclusion where diversity is honored." Strick says he thinks the adoption showed the city trying to move forward from that checkered history, but that it's an ongoing challenge to make sure that everyone in the community feels represented and welcomed.
Not only included, but helping to lead our community. And I think that that's a challenge everywhere, that I think, again, the dynamics here being a nearly all-white community are unique, but the underlying tensions and dynamics, they come out of the same place. And so how do we embrace this? How do we work through this? How do we allow ourselves to be challenged?
Lowen has also written about the portrayal of sundown towns in entertainment. He says he knows of five movies that talk about sundown towns, including recent Academy Award winner for Best Picture, Green Book, all of which set these towns in the Deep South.
And then on the other hand, famous movie made in Indiana, Hoosiers, among other things, it's about the basketball team in Milam, Indiana, which was a sundown town, which beats another basketball team from another sundown town, and they're playing in the sectional part of the statewide tournament in Jasper, Indiana, which is a third sundown town. And yet Hollywood never mentions this. Indeed, they put a couple of black folks in the crowd scenes.
Lowen keeps a running website of confirmed and suspected sundown towns and encourages visitors to help him confirm towns.
Many people living in some sundown towns have no idea. And of course, I'm saying many white people. Black people, too, don't know. People who don't want to know usually don't know. So it's good to get that truth about the past out, because then it takes away your illusions.
Lone says it's important to chronicle this part of town's history to avoid what he calls second-generation sundown town problems, problems that look like a mostly white police force or mostly white educators. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Ella Abbott.
Hear part two of this story on tomorrow's Regionally Speaking. Purdue University mechanical engineering professor and his team has been working for some time on a way to perhaps eliminate air conditioning in buildings during warm weather climates. And in an effort to curb global warming, he and his team have created the whitest white acrylic paint, which reflects 98.1% of sunlight and deflects infrared heat. That allows buildings to cool beyond the surrounding air temperatures. Purdue podcast producer Katie Young spoke with this professor, and he shared his surprise at the amount of attention these inventions received, not only in the science and engineering world, but also in the art space as well. And he also breaks down how this paint can help save people money on their electric bills.
Shulin Ruan is a professor of mechanical engineering at Purdue University. His giant leap as a boilermaker, inventing the whitest paint on record in an effort to curb global warming. We'll get more into the paint's effect on climate, but one of the most interesting things Shulin shared with me, when the team first started this project, they didn't actually set out to create the whitest white paint.
When we started the project about 7 years ago, we had the energy savings and fighting climate change in mind.
That's right. This invention is 7 years in the making. Shulin explains.
We started working on this in 2014. You know, we tested many different materials, concentrations, and the different particle sizes and so on. So it does take a lot of effort. And many students who graduated and then new students continued the effort to really make it happen. So using radio cooling in paints really started in the 1960s. At that time, people were trying to create white paint that can reflect the sunlight as much as they can. And at the same time, we know any surfaces, when you put on the roof, they're going to emit their own heat to the surrounding as well. So the problem was that at that time, the whitest paint they people created can reflect 80 to 90% of sunlight, which means they absorb 10 to 20%. Of the sunlight. So that's still too much heat absorbed from the sunlight, and that's more than the heat they lose. So although they are cooler than the other colored paints, they cannot be cooled below the ambient temperature. You know, a few years back, we started on this, first inspired by a group at the Stanford University, which created multi-layer nanostructures that can do below ambient cooling, but was very expensive, not viable for buildings. So we went ahead and think about, you know, whether we can create the paints to be below the ambient temperature, because we had much better nanotechnology than half a century ago. So we eventually came up with this new paint formula, with a few innovations compared to the commercial white paints.
This new whitest white acrylic paint reflects 98.1% of sunlight, compared with the 95.5% of sunlight reflected by the team's previous ultra-white paint. It deflects infrared heat, allowing buildings to cool below the surrounding air temperature. In fact, the team's tests have shown that the paint is able to keep a surface around 8 degrees cooler than its ambient temperature in the afternoon, and up to 19 degrees cooler at night. But what makes this paint the coolest? A very high concentration of a chemical compound called barium sulfate. It's also used to make photo paper and cosmetics white. Barium sulfate was used in the paint in pigment particles of various sizes, which allows the paint to scatter more of the light spectrum from the sun. But the barium sulfate used had to be just the right amount. If they used a higher concentration of this, it would likely cause the paint to break or peel off, according to the research team. Shulin walks us through how this new paint differs from commercial paint you can go buy at a local hardware store.
Tell us about
what's in the paint. How is this different from if you go to the store and buy a regular can of paint?
It has a few key innovations compared to the commercial white paints you can buy. I mean, that's took us a long time to figure out actually each aspect, each innovation over the years. Now, first, the commercial white paints are based on titanium dioxide. So titanium dioxide reflects very well in the visible portion and the near infrared portion of the sunlight, but it absorbs the UV. So we first went out to look for materials that would not absorb UV at all. That those included oxides, carbonates, and sulfates. So those were our candidates. But that's not sufficient. We came to realize that we need a much higher concentration in the commercial paints. So commercial paints, they usually have less than 10% of the particle loading, and that's not sufficient to reflect sunlight for the energy purpose. So we tested different particle loading and eventually landed at 60%. And it's an appropriate number to sufficiently reflect and scatter sunlight. At the same time, it still behaves like a paint. So a third key innovation that really pushed our paint to the performance we see today is not using a uniform size. That's kind of a little bit counterintuitive at the beginning, but our predictions showed us eventually if you use a single size, it only reflects one wavelength of the sunlight really well, not the other wavelengths. So once you have different particle size in your paint, each size will be responsible to reflect one wavelength in the sunlight. So eventually, the whole spectrum of sunlight can be reflected effectively. So these are the three key differences from the commercial paints. I can summarize again. First is a material that does not absorb UV. Second, high particle concentration. Third, non-uniform particle sizes.
Throughout Shulin's journey with creating this paint and pushing the limits on their previous white paint, of course, came with challenges and roadblocks. The team had considered over 100 different materials, narrowed them down to 10, and tested about 50 different formulations for each material.
To be honest, 7 years ago, we didn't, know that we would achieve such great reflectance today. So we did run into a lot of roadblocks, and then, but we're really happy that working with our students, postdocs, we were able to overcome these challenges, and that led us to arrive where we are today. So each innovation actually came out of the challenges we were facing. For example, at the beginning, we were trying to push the titanium dioxide that is used in commercial paints to perform very well. So we made many different trials based on titanium dioxide, different particle loading, different substrate. We at that time, we didn't believe we were able to achieve this in a single layer. So we tried putting these materials into a two-layer structure and so on. So after many trials, we were not able to get cooling below the ambient temperature, and we came to realize it's the materials problem. So that's how we set out to look for other materials like brom sulfate, calcite, and so on. But even with that, we tested many materials, maybe as many as 100 materials. Some materials we kind of expected them to work, but it didn't work eventually. We also had a hard time on the matrix material like polymer to use. Some of the particle fillers, they don't really like the polymer. I mean, they were not able to disperse them so well in the polymer matrix or binders. So we kind of explore that to find the good pair of the filler as well as the polymer to have a good dispersion. We came to realize, the particle concentration was not high enough. So we tested many particle concentration. And the last maybe challenge I want to highlight is that after we've done all these, we were trying to explain the performance, why it is 98.1%. So using previous models, we are not able to match the prediction with our experimental data. To be more specific, the theory says that reflectance should be lower than the experimental measurements. And, we spend time on that and eventually find out that that's because we have different particle size in it. Usually, previously, people just neglect the non-uniformity in the size. And we found that it plays a very important role increasing your reflectance from just above 90 now to 98.1%. So I have to say that, the innovations were pushed by the challenges we were facing. And that's how the science and engineering works.
I love that quote. The innovations were pushed by the challenges we were facing, and that's how science and engineering works. As Boilermakers, Shu Lin and his team continued in their persistent pursuit of making this paint a reality.
That is This is Purdue podcast producer Katie Young with mechanical engineering professor Shu Ruan. The United States has secured more doses than the country's COVID-19 vaccine needs. But around the world, millions of people have no access to vaccines in their home countries. And Side Effects Public Media's Farah Yousri tells us that that makes some people travel thousands of miles to get a shot here in the United States. That is, if they can afford it.
You may have heard of people crossing the southern border into the U.S. to get a COVID vaccine. But increasingly, some people who can afford it are crossing the world to do just that.
So all in all, I think it's going to be around 25 or 26 hours, including her transits in two countries.
That's Merhan Omran. She's Egyptian and lives in Sunbury, Ohio, but her family's back home in Egypt. She was anxious about her mom flying here all the way from Egypt. That's 11,000 miles of flying and nearly $1,000 in airfare. Her mom, Sarah Ismail, arrived in Ohio on time, and she was on a mission.
Hi. Yes, we're checking in for the COVID vaccine.
Ismail is jet-lagged, but still shows up on time at a local CVS for her Pfizer vaccine shot. And Omran keeps her company.
Do you want to take this middle chair in here? And do you want your right or your left arm?
This one. My mom is considered a senior, and with the underlying conditions, like she deserves to be given priority. But in Egypt, this doesn't happen.
And that's because the supply of COVID vaccines is very limited in countries like Egypt. In fact, less than 5% of residents there are fully vaccinated.
This is really a symptom of a broken system.
This is Dr. Tom Frieden. He heads the group Resolve to Save Lives and is a former director of the CDC.
Fundamentally, it's starvation in the midst of plenty. And that's not just ethically unacceptable, that's epidemiologically hazardous, because the spread of COVID means increased risk of more dangerous variants.
This global vaccine disparity is happening as demand in the U.S. dwindled over the summer and wasted doses piled up. Sage Khanna is an entrepreneur who works in Indianapolis. His father lives in New Delhi and got COVID last year, spending 3 weeks in the hospital. So as soon as vaccines started rolling out in the U.S., he flew to Indianapolis to get his shot. Khanna's wife arranged one for her mother, who also lives in India.
Nobody asked, are you a citizen or not? They're just giving you the vaccine.
And that's been encouraging many who have the means to travel to the U.S. for a shot. But most people just don't have this luxury.
For my family members, if we had the luxury of bringing them here to get the vaccine, then I absolutely would have done that.
That's Dr. Mohammed Hajiri, a cardiologist in Mansfield, Ohio. His family's in Jordan and Syria with no valid U.S. visa. He says back home, people trust American science and medicine, but misinformation about vaccines in the U.S. can reverberate overseas. He refers to videos of one American doctor, popular online and on some conservative American media outlets.
His videos circulate all over the Arab world, all the Middle East. Jordan people, they're like, no, I heard about this American doctor who says that this is going to alter your DNA, that there's a little chip in there.
He cautions that U.S. officials must continue to combat such misinformation so that when more vaccines do make it to countries now lacking them, people there would roll up their sleeves for a shot. Farah Yousri, Side Effects Public Media.
The Hard Rock Casino Northern Indiana in Gary is celebrating a historic Asian festival this week, one which is the second most celebrated holiday in Asia. I sat down on Friday with Jenny Moy, the Director of Asian Player Development with the casino, and the Yu Yu Noodle Bar's chef, who is Chef Chung, to talk about the festival, about its celebration, and the very special dessert that is served every year and at the Noodle Bar this past weekend and again today. Will you explain some of the history about the festival and certainly what's come over here to the United States now?
Mid-Autumn Festival is one of the most celebrated, but if not, it is the second most celebrated holiday in the Asian countries. It is a on the Lunar New Year. On the lunar calendar, on August 15th
of the lunar calendar.
On this day, it is to be said, and it is that it will be the day that the moon is at its fullest, and it is at its brightest, and it is closest to the Earth. For us, for Asians, this is part of the harvest season as well. So everyone comes home to celebrate this holiday with their families for a get-together. During this time, this is kind of comparable to the American Thanksgiving, and this is something that, you know, like I said, families, friends coming from all over, we get together for this festivity. Now, growing up, Chef and I had said to you guys, explained that, you know, growing up, we remember there are, in our festivities, when we are home with our family, there are lanterns, there are riddles and folk tales and things like that. You know, that is part of the festivities, right? Chef, remember running around with lanterns when he was growing up? You know, I remember one of my favorite things is always the mooncake. Now, the mooncake is a delicacy pastry that to make this mooncake, it started out probably in, you know, in the beginning of the year, it's a lot of preparations to make these mooncakes. So they have prepped it since the beginning of the year. And it is a traditional mooncake have the lotus paste with two egg yolks in there. So as they prepare for this, preserve and through the year, by the time that harvest day come, mid-autumn festival come, it is ready for us to make this and enjoy this along with our dinner. So one of that was, so for us, when we get together, for a lot of the Asians, we get together with our families. The biggest thing is the festivities, the meals that we get, and the mooncakes that we enjoy with our family. You know, the mooncake comes in all different sizes, but typically it is a round shape, and the round shape represents unity, the round shape represents reunion and fullness compared to the moon. So this is one of the biggest things, what we call the mooncake, that we share with everyone.
Now, you mentioned that since the mooncake itself is always round, if they come here to the UU Noodle Bar to order something and they take advantage of the mooncake, this looks different. Tell us about what the cake that will be offered here at the Noodle Bar is going to look like. And it looks like it's very special because it's in a special shape. Like it's actually a cake that's baked in a special mold. Is this true?
Yes. And, you know, Chef can also get more into that later on too. But I would tell you that, so starting tomorrow, September 18th, September 19th, and September 21st, here at the UU Noodle Bar, anytime from 5 p.m. to 2 in the morning, if anyone came in to dine in and with a purchase of an entree, we will give out a complimentary mooncake. Now, our mooncake came a long way. We will always have our traditional one. And throughout, we will always have what we call the more modern, the mainstream one as well. So mooncakes came a long way. Throughout the years now, I would tell you that there are many different flavors. So over here, we offer the traditional mooncake flavor, which is your lotus paste with two egg yolks. We also offer the snow skin, which is very comparable to like a ice cream kind of pastry filling inside, where there's mango flavor and strawberry flavor. We also have a pineapple flavor. There is a durian flavor. That's another one, a favorite one amongst the Asian community. So we'll have the different variety of mooncakes here to offer for anyone who wants to come out here and try this out.
All right. Let me ask you, Chef, tell us, since you have this traditional size mooncake that will be offered, and as I mentioned, it looks differently. The others are just more round and what we would expect here in I guess the United States. Tell us about this more traditional mooncake that you have offered here for this year.
Okay, the more traditional mooncake is like
the lotus seed and then the duck yolk, you know, inside. And then it's like a round shape, you know. And then we started like early in the beginning of the year, then we harvest those lotus seed and then grind it into paste. And then we preserve the duck egg, you know, just the yolk. And then when the time comes, then we grind the paste and then we make the mold and then we bake it, you know. Yep.
It has a very distinctive flavor, and I think people will like it. It's a nice blend of flavors. If you can describe it, you have to taste it, really, to know yourself if you like it. But can you describe what the flavor of a more traditional mooncake might be like?
Well, it's the lotus, like a sweet lotus flavor. So it's like a conscious flavor. The sweetness of the lotus versus the saltiness of the egg yolk. You know, and then also, that's the traditional one, is called the mixed nut. So it's the different kind of nut, and then stuff inside the mooncake also.
And it seems like it's a very nice balance between salty and sweet. It's not like a peanut flavor or peanut butter flavor, but it kind of has that salty flavor, and it is, blends very well with, like you say, the salty and sweet. It's a nice balance. So it seems like you have to work an awful lot to make it taste that way.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. Yes. It takes a lot of time to, you know, it takes time to brand it right, to make it right, yep.
Now, Jenny, we were talking about the festival, and at least you talked about what in your family, how you celebrated the festival. Besides the mooncakes, is there anything special that your family may fix for a meal? Or is a lot of it traditional Chinese fare?
So, absolutely. Like, for me growing up, and it's always coming home or having the home-cooked meals. And throughout the years, is anything, if it was in Asia, is anything that they had harvest throughout the year, and then they will make this for this holiday. For me at home here, I grew up in Chicago, so my family would try to make some of those, whether it's noodles or a rice dish, or, you know, they will also make it to a home-cooked meal that they would make at in Asia, and they make it for us over here. So I look forward, to me, it's very, very special. This is something we celebrate every year. So this is something that I look forward to, you know, whether it's once a year to celebrate the Moon Autumn Festival, that I go home to my parents, my family, friends, they would come over for dinner, and we have a great feast with our family. And the one thing we look forward to is that mooncake at the end of the meal is what we look forward to, enjoying.
That's Jenny Moy with the Hard Rock Casino Northern Indiana talking about Mid-Autumn Asian Moon Festival, which is being celebrated at the casino in Gary this week. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.